Berkeley was purring in her lap, like a bandsaw.
Kind of.
Yeah, Lawrence said. His shoulders were a scaffolding around his ears.
Good weird or bad weird?
Just weird. Weirdness is value neutral. I should go. See you at school.
Lawrence fled, almost as fast as Berkeley might have, before Patricia could say anything else. She couldn't go after him. She finally had a purring cat in her lap. Her familiar.
Damn. She'd hoped this wasn't going to be freaky. What kind of dumbass was she, doing magic like that in front of an outsider? It had been his idea, true, but still.
She started petting Berkeley.
We're just going to protect each other. Okay? He showed no sign that he could still understand her, but whatever. She had finally done a proper spell. On purpose, this time.
Chapter 8. Lawrence's Cheap Jack lunch tray wobbled, sagging under the weight of so much undercooked starch, as he tried to figure out where to sit, as far away from Patricia Delphine as possible. She sat there, in their usual spot, near the compost and trash bins, trying to catch his eye, one brow raised under her messy bangs. The longer he stood, the less stable his tray felt, and the more she seemed to squirm in the corner of his eye. Finally, Lawrence took a sharp left and went to sit on the back steps, near where the skaters skateboarded after school, perching the plastic tray on his knees. It was technically against the rules to eat out here, but who cared? He kept thinking he should try to talk to Patricia, but then he would remember the weirdness. The image of her shimmying around and doing that thing with her hands, and then having a dialogue with her pet in cat noises for an uncomfortable length of time, was enough to make Lawrence dry heave. He pictured the two of them hanging out and Patricia offering to talk to the local wildlife on his behalf, maybe doing her heebie-jeebie dance again. The whispers Lawrence had been hearing about Patricia around the school felt much more relevant now that he'd seen her in action. Lately, he'd been finding any excuse to sit near the graceful, long-limbed Dorothy Glass, and he heard Dorothy and her friends sharing a whole mythos about that girl who kept frogs in her locker. People still thought Lawrence was dating Patricia, no matter how he denied it. He couldn't help remembering Patricia's warning about witch cooties.
Hey! Patricia came out the back door and stood right behind him, casting a shadow in his face as he tried to eat his buttery potato wedges.
Lawrence kept chewing.
Hey!
Patricia said again, angrier this time.
Hey!
Lawrence didn't turn around.
What's going on? Why are you ignoring me? Seriously, please talk to me. This is driving me nuts.
The shadow over Lawrence flickered and changed shape, because Patricia was gesturing.
It was your idea. You suggested it. And then I did it, and you freaked out and bailed. Who treats their friends that way?
We shouldn't talk about this at school, Lawrence said very quietly, using his fork as the opposite of a microphone.
Okay, Patricia said.
So when do you want to talk about this?
I just want to keep my head down, Lawrence said, until I can get out of this place. That's all I want.
An ant stumbled, hoisting Lawrence's breadcrumb. Maybe Patricia could give it a pep talk in ant language.
I thought you hated your parents because they just want to keep their heads down.
Lawrence felt a weird combination of shame and rage, as though he'd grown another new body part just in time to get punched in it. He seized his tray and pushed his way past Patricia, not caring if he got potato dregs on himself or on her, and hurried back inside.
And, of course, someone saw him rushing in the hallway with a half-laden tray and stuck out a leg to trip him up. He ended up face down in his own muck. It never failed. Later that day, Brad Chomner tried to cram Lawrence's entire body into a single-file urinal, and then both Brad and Lawrence got hauled into Mr. Dibbs's office for fighting, as if they were equal instigators. Mr. Dibbs called Lawrence's parents to come get him. "That school is crushing the life out of me," Lawrence told his parents at dinner. "I need to get out of there. I've already filled out the application form to transfer to the math and science school, and I just need you guys to sign it." He slid it onto the chipped formica table, where it sat amidst the faded placemats.
"We're just not sure you're mature enough to go to school in the city by yourself,"
Lawrence's dad carved into his casserole with the edge of his fork, making little snuffling noises with his nose and mouth.
"Mr. Dibbs is concerned that you're a disruptive influence. Just because you get good grades, snarf, snorf, doesn't mean you can be a bad element."
"You haven't proved you can handle the responsibility you already have," said Lawrence's mother. "You can't make trouble all the time."
"Your mother and I don't make trouble," said Lawrence's father. "We make other things, because we're adults."
"What?"
Lawrence shoved his casserole away and took a heavy swig of cola instead. "What do you make, exactly? Either of you guys?"
"Don't talk back," said Lawrence's father.
"This isn't about us," said Lawrence's mother.
"No, I want to know. It occurs to me I have no clue what either of you produces." Lawrence looked at his dad.
"You're a lower middle manager who denies people's insurance claims for a living."
He looked at his mom. "You update instruction manuals for obsolete machinery. What do either of you make?"
"We put a roof over your head," his father said.
"And delicious liver and peas casserole on your plate," his mother said.
"Oh, Jesus."
Lawrence had never talked to his parents like this before, and he didn't know what had come over him.
"You have no idea how hard I pray not to turn out like you two. My every nightmare, every one, is about turning into a complacent failure like you both. You don't even remember the dreams you threw away to sink into this hole."
And with that, he pushed his chair hard enough to scar the cheap linoleum and got upstairs before his parents could send him to his room or try to muster some fake outrage. He locked the door. Lawrence wished Isabel and her rocketeer friends would come and take him away. She was helping to run a startup aerospace company that was actually making deliveries to the space station, and he kept reading articles where she was quoted about the brave new future of space travel. After Lawrence flopped onto his bed and gazed up at his ceiling-wide poster, in which every fictional spaceship congregated at a massive nebula, he remembered how he'd spoken to his parents. If he strained to listen over the dozen cooling fans along one wall of his bedroom, he could hear his parents fighting. Not the kind of fight where anybody hopes to win, or even find some solution. This was hopeless, pointless, mindless aggression. Two creatures caught in a trap with nothing to do but tear each other apart. Lawrence wanted to die. His mother sounded more wounded, his father more fatalistic. But they had identical levels of bitterness. Lawrence put a pillow over his head. It did no good. He wound up putting his headphones on, with the latest girl trash songs that everybody was listening to at school, and then a pair of winter earmuffs over them. Now he could no longer hear his parents, but he could still imagine what they were saying. He focused on the crooning, growling voice of the girl trash singer, whose name was Hetta Necco, and he found himself with an erection. Ignoring it did as much good as ignoring these things ever did. He hated himself, even as he let one hand drift down and carry out the motion he'd practiced incessantly of late. Just as Lawrence splashed onto a dirty fast-food napkin, he both heard and felt one of his parents slamming the front door of their house. He didn't know which. I wish I were dead and in hell, Lawrence thought. Lawrence didn't sleep much. The next morning, he felt too sick for school, but he knew better than to ask to stay home. He barely noticed when kids threw erasers at him or refused to let him sign their petition to save something or other, because if he signed it, then nobody else would. When Lawrence got home that afternoon, he found the form sitting on the kitchen table, signed by both parents. Neither was home. At dinner, he tried to thank them, but they just shrugged and looked at the table. The three of them ate in total silence. The next day, Lawrence just stood in the hallway, watching it drain of people. He realized his buttons were buttoned wrong, so his jacket was askew. Patricia came up to him in the hallway.
"You're going to be late," she said. "They're going to kill you."
For the first time ever, Lawrence noticed that Patricia was pretty. Her skin had a brightness underlying its faint tan, like an airbrushed picture he'd seen once. Her neck was really smooth and graceful, and her wrist pivoted as she held her backpack on her shoulder. Her dark hair fell almost over one gray-green eye. He wanted to grab her by the shoulders. He wanted to run away from her. He wanted to kiss her. He wanted to scream. Instead, he said, "Do you want to ditch school?"
"Why?" she said.
"And go where?"
"Let's go to the woods," he said. "I want to see your magic tree."
He no longer cared if this girl was crazy. He was a bad person. And what was worse, being crazy or being evil? Plus, she might be the only girl who would even consider kissing him before he turned 30. And he was growing more conscious that he had been a dick to her.
"You want to go to the woods with me?" Patricia said.
"Right now." Lawrence nodded. He needed to fidget. He didn't. He thought about how dull the tiles underfoot were. Someone waxed them every day, leaving them shiny for an hour until they dried and hundreds of kids walked on them, and then the floor just looked sticky and gray with wax scum. The floor probably looked dirtier than if nobody ever waxed it.
"I'm sorry," Patricia said. "I can't. I have to stay on at this school, after you've gone on to your math paradise."
"Sure," Lawrence said.
"Okay."
He wanted to say something else, like maybe apologize, but he didn't. And then the moment had evaporated, and they were walking to separate classes. When Theodolphus Rose was 14, he'd slept on a bunk of mossy slate. He had mastered 100 ways to kill a woman without awakening the man sleeping next to her. Every morning, an hour before dawn, the 14-year-old Theodolphus had gone for a 10-mile run with a ceramic urn full of his teacher's urine on his head, and if a single drop spilled, or he failed to complete the 10 miles within an hour and a half, he would be forced to stand on his head until he saw a river of sunfire. His only meals had been the not-quite-lethal mushrooms and berries he'd been taught to pick in the thickets near the cliff-sheltered school fortress. And yet the Nameless Assassin School was a country club compared to Canterbury Academy. For one thing, he had been learning things, skills that he still used in his vocation, and he had taken pride in them. For another, nobody had forced him to answer multiple-choice questions on battered notebook computers. If they had given standardized tests in assassin school, he wouldn't have lasted a day. Theodolphus made a mental note to hunt down Lars Serinian, the psychologist who had studied the slaughterhouse behavior of pigs and come up with an educational regimen for human children, when he finally got out of here. Theodolphus had spent weeks spying on these two children, listening to all of their conversations, at home and at school. He'd parked across the street from their houses and eavesdropped on the two of them, together and separately. He'd racked his brains trying to come up with a death that didn't require his hands-on involvement, thus complying with the letter of child murder ban, but would still tell a good story. Something artistic. He had this notion that the children would go into the woods together, where Lawrence could be bitten by a snake, and then Patricia could try sucking the poison out of him and accidentally poison herself. But no, because Patricia was forbidden to go into the woods, and she was the only child on Earth who obeyed her parents, Theodolphus kept hoping Patricia would have a moment of rebelliousness and being brutalized by disappointment. By now, after weeks of slouching on purpose in his office chair, listening to Brad Chomner talk about his body image issues, Theodolphus just wanted this over with. This was the longest he'd gone without killing someone in years, and his hands kept getting ideas. He sat in faculty meetings and imagined just how much of Don Gluckman's insides he could show the math teacher while keeping him alive. Worst of all was when Theodolphus had to give advice about puberty, something he had never personally experienced. Lucy Dodd got a stomach flu, not Theodolphus's work, and they needed someone to teach English for a few days. Theodolphus volunteered. It would give him another chance to study his prey, since both Lawrence and Patricia took that class. All of the kids had clearly been looking forward to having a sub so they could goof off. When they saw it was Theodolphus, wearing a crisp black shirt, matching black pants, and a red tie, they all sighed with disappointment. For some reason, Theodolphus had become the most popular faculty member at this school, and nobody felt like screwing with him. "Most of you know me," he said, making eye contact with each surly dough face in turn. Lawrence and Patricia sat at separate tables, not talking to each other, not even looking at each other, except that the girl kept giving the boy wounded little glances. The boy glared at his secondhand scarlet letter. Tracy Burt read out a passage she'd memorized with perfect diction and a smile full of ceramic braces. Then Theodolphus attempted to get a discussion going about Hester Prynne and whether she was unfairly treated, and got back a lot of canned answers about Puritan morality. And then he called on Lawrence.
"Mr. Armstead, do you think society needs to burn the occasional witch for the sake of social cohesion?"
"What?" Lawrence jumped, so that three legs of his chair left the ground. He dropped all his books on the floor. Everybody else laughed and texted.
"I'm sorry," Lawrence babbled, gathering up all his stuff. "I don't know what you mean."
"Oh, yes," Theodolphus said to himself. "You know perfectly well."
"I see." Theodolphus made a scritch on a paper, as if writing the boy off. "How about you, Miss Delphine? Do you think the occasional witch-burning helps to weld society together?"
Patricia lost a breath. Then she found it again and looked up, regarding Theodolphus with a steadiness that he couldn't help admiring. Her thin lips pushed out.
"Well," Patricia said, "a society that has to burn witches to hold itself together is a society that has already failed and just doesn't know it yet."
With that, Theodolphus knew how he would finish this mission and redeem his professional self-respect once and for all. Chapter 9. The snowstorm hit a few weeks after Lawrence more or less stopped talking to Patricia. She woke up with Berkeley curled between her bent elbow and her shoulder and looked out her window without getting all the way out of bed. The ground and the sky mirrored each other, two sheets of white. Patricia shuddered and almost pulled the covers over her head. Instead, she took the hottest shower she could bear and put on her long johns for the first time this year. They no longer fit. Patricia's mother was already on site, and her father was multi-focusing with his laptop and a stack of folders, so at least Patricia didn't have to talk to her parents. But Roberta came down halfway through breakfast and just stared at Patricia without talking, and that was creepy. And at last Roberta went off to Ellenberg High, and Patricia was left hoping against hope that Canterbury Academy was having a snow day. No such luck. Patricia got to school in her dad's sedan and almost broke her neck on the slushy steps. People threw snowballs with gravel in them at Patricia's head, but she didn't bother to turn and look. That would just be presenting a better target.
"Miss Delphine,"
a smooth, deep voice said behind Patricia in the near-empty hallway. A lot of kids had stayed home, after all. Patricia turned to see Mr. Rose, the guidance counselor, with the knuckle face, looming in a pinstriped slate suit. Yes? Mr. Rose had never made much of an impression, though everybody said he was the only decent authority figure at this cruddy school. But today he seemed dark and towering, a foot taller than normal. Patricia shrugged this off as just snow day nerves.
"I was hoping to discuss something with you,"
Mr. Rose said in a deeper than usual voice.
"Perhaps you could come by my office when you get a moment. I find that I have an unusually free schedule today."
Patricia said, "Sure," and dashed off to first period. The school was half empty, and the snow kept blinding her through the windows. It all felt like a weird dream. Her first class was math, and Mr. Gluckman wasn't even trying to teach. Everybody just goofed off. Her second period teacher hadn't even made it to school, so it became a free period after 10 minutes of perfunctory waiting. Patricia drifted toward Mr. Rose's office.
"Thank you for coming on such short notice. I will keep this brief."
Mr. Rose's teeth clacked inside his dry white lips. This wasn't the Mr. Rose Patricia was used to. He sat straighter in his gray chair, hands folded on his walnut desk with its cartoon walrus pencil holder. Behind him, there was a wall of books on child development. Patricia nodded. Mr. Rose took a deep breath.
"I have a message for you,"
he said.
"From the tree."
The what? Patricia felt sure this was a dream. The pale world, the empty school. She was still in bed with Berkeley.
"Well, not the tree, exactly, but the power the tree represents. I know you've waited a long time to fulfill your purpose as a witch. You've been more than patient, so I have been tasked with informing you that your wait is almost over. The secrets will soon be yours."
Patricia couldn't breathe. Her hands were gripping her chair arms. She felt hot around her face and yet freezing in her extremities. Her blood was all going to her head, as if it were preparing to separate from her body. Her feet kicked each other.
"What?"
she said at last.
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean."
She was on the verge of babbling, but reined it in. This was important witch business.
Who are you?"
She wouldn't have disbelieved, necessarily, if he'd claimed to be Merlin or something.
"I'm your school guidance counselor."
Mr. Rose smiled with one lip.
"I'm just passing along a message, that's all. This is the only time you and I will ever discuss this matter."
"Oh, okay."
"You will be receiving instructions soon. In the meantime, there is one task you must perform."
Stop saying
Patricia told herself.
Is it like a test or an assignment? Do I have to prove myself worthy?"
"You have already proved everything you needed to prove. No, this is merely a task, but an unpleasant one. There is a boy at this school who will grow up to be a great enemy of nature and a persecutor of the magical community. You already know him. His name is Lawrence Armstead. He may have asked to see a demonstration of magic recently. He may even have asked you to show him the tree. Is this so?"
Yeah.
This conversation was like falling off the edge of the world, plummeting all the way around the globe and then falling off the edge a second time. Patricia's stomach was upside down.
So you already know. I hate to say this, and remember, I'm just the messenger. I regard all human life as precious and irreplaceable. But Lawrence Armstead must die, and you must be the one to kill him. Nobody else can do it. As soon as you complete this task, you can begin your training.
Patricia couldn't remember what she said after that. It probably had a lot of in it. She didn't say she would kill Lawrence, and she didn't say she wouldn't. She may have thanked Mr. Rose for the message. She wasn't sure. She was in an upright coma for the rest of the day. Even Roberta, hanging from the banister upside down and staring at her after dinner, barely registered. Roberta's dark brown hair hung straight down and her eyebrows twitched, but she said nothing as Patricia walked past. Patricia found herself in Roberta's room an hour later, right before lights out.
"Bert,"
she said, using her old nickname,
"could you kill a person, if you absolutely had to?"
Roberta was painting her toenails candy apple green in her white cotton PJs.
"Wow, Trish. Morbid much?"
She laughed. "For your information, the answer is yes and no. Yes, I would be willing, if I felt it was necessary and whatever, but I probably couldn't go through with it. I would be too much of a wuss to look at someone and take them out, even if I was sure it was the right thing."
Okay. Thanks.
But Trish," Roberta called after Patricia as she turned to go to her own room across the hallway, "if you do ever take someone out, I get to watch. I want to see you do it."
Okay.
Lawrence was back at school the next day, in a good mood for a change, swinging his arms in the wet hallways like he owned the place. He was back to not talking to Patricia, but he smiled at her without looking right at her. She could so easily end him. Just push him in front of one of the senior citizen tour buses the school used as transportation. It would look like an accident. Patricia found herself studying his twitchy head and slender wrists, trying to imagine if it could be true. Was he going to become an enemy of magic? He was already hostile to it, that was for sure. Maybe the grown-up Lawrence could be some kind of monster, for all she knew, persecuting her kind. Maybe this was part of what witches did, regretfully, sorrowfully, snuffing out people who would threaten the balance of nature. She watched him in the cafeteria, punishing his food. She watched him running wind sprints up and down the hill behind the school, shivering in his track uniform. She tried to imagine him launching a vendetta, persecuting her friends, if she ever actually had friends. She couldn't make herself believe it, and she couldn't do it unless she did. She could imagine killing him. That was shockingly easy. One shove into the big wheels. But she couldn't imagine him deserving it. Whenever she tried to talk to Mr. Rose, he was either busy or absent. She finally caught up with him in the hallway near the teacher lounge and tried to mention the tree. He looked at her as if she was speaking gibberish, one brow raised.
"At home," she asked, "Change Me, will Lawrence become an enemy of magic?"
Change Me responded, "Do you think Lawrence will become an enemy of magic?"
"I'm asking you."
"Why are you asking me?"
She couldn't get to sleep for ages, even with Berkeley scrunched along her ribcage. But then she finally slept and dreamed she was carving Lawrence open with a big knife. His skin parted to reveal a shining portal to a magical land full of kind wizards who gave her a wand of her own. She dreamed she lured him to the Wadlow River cliff where the high school kids partied and shoved him off the edge onto the sharp, slippery rocks. She woke up crying and shaking and holding on to Berkeley for dear life. Someone threw a rock at Patricia's head before school started. Not a snowball with rocks in it, just a plain chunk of granite. Patricia ducked, but slipped on the path. Lawrence grabbed her arm and helped her to her feet. He steadied her and seemed to be trying to say something. Then he walked away, like he usually did these days whenever he was about to speak to her. First period, Patricia reached in her backpack for her textbook, and something else spilled out. A pair of panties, with a stain she couldn't identify and didn't care to examine further. She was sure they hadn't been there when she left the house. The other kids at her table, including Macy Firestone, started laughing and taking photos.
"What's that commotion?" Mr. Gluckman asked from the board.
"Someone has put something unspeakable in my bag."
Patricia tried to sound dignified, not like a victim, but not like a troublemaker either.
"Emo bitch,"
someone hissed from the corner.
"That's no excuse for disrupting my class."
Mr. Gluckman frowned between gray sideburns.
"You are taking time away from all of the children who are here to learn something."
"I didn't do anything," Patricia said. "Somebody else..."
"If someone has been storing inappropriate items in someone's bag, I suggest you take it up with the principal or Mr. Dibbs."
Patricia looked around, a room full of pure entertainment. She caught Lawrence's eye, and he gave her a blank, helpless look.
"Fine," Patricia stood up. "I will. May I be excused?"
She didn't wait for an answer. The door crashed shut behind her, failing to block out the cheers and applause. She made it halfway to Mr. Dibbs's office before Mr. Dibbs charged around a corner and grabbed her arm.
"You," he grabbed her arm with one meaty hand, "have some explaining to do."
She tried talking to him, but he hauled her right into the girls' room, where she saw, written in blood on the wall, "Death is excellent." It wasn't human blood. It wasn't fresh blood. It was definitely blood, though. Whoever had done this had left plastic containers from the butcher shop in the trash. The paint was dripping, the message still melting on the wall. Someone had gone into the girls' room and painted this right after first period began, without anybody noticing. You would have to be a ninja.
"What?"
Patricia felt frostbitten from the inside out. The stench was punishing, a noxious slaughterhouse odor, the dying distress of cattle immortalized in smell form. She couldn't bear to be in the same room with it. Mr. Dibbs's jaw twitched under his dark, thick beard. He gestured at the wall with his free hand.
"You are going to clean this up, and then we are going to call your parents to come and have a conversation about civilized behavior and barbarism and the vital, the crucial, difference between the two."
"I didn't... Please let go of my arm. You're hurting me."
She couldn't hear herself talk. He jerked her closer to the wall, so she was inches away from it.
"I don't know anything about this. Please let go of my arm. Corporal punishment is illegal in school, and you're hurting me. Please let go of my arm."
Mr. Dibbs let go of her, but he was already turning to go call Patricia's parents. They wouldn't listen to her either. There would be three adults screaming at her instead of one.
"Listen," Patricia said. "Whoever did this, they did it during first period. Lots of girls went to the bathroom before first period, and there was no blood on the wall then. And everybody saw me in first period. I was the first to arrive at math class. There's no way I could have done this. So excuse me, sir, I'm going back to math class now."
Her victory left Patricia with soiled panties still to dispose of, and a classroom full of kids who kept trying to take photos of her to post on Instagram with mean comments. The blood graffiti stayed on the bathroom wall the rest of the day. The school janitor refused to go near it on religious grounds. Nobody knew what religion he was exactly, and he wouldn't say. Patricia kept feeling as though she was going to blow chunks as she sat in classroom after classroom listening to the other kids whispering and the teachers trying to carry on as if nothing had happened. She couldn't throw up if she were willing to, because the whole school had just a dozen toilet stalls for girls now, and the lines were forever. She did wait in line once to pee, and girls kept shoving her by accident. Patricia tried to talk to Lawrence once or twice, but he kept slipping away. As she reached the doorway, she noticed Mr. Rose studying her from inside the school. He'd gone back to normal size. She remembered what she'd been trying not to think about. He'd told her she'd be going away soon from this terrible place. Her training would begin. She would be free and luminous, a real witch. She only had to complete one small task. Chapter 10. Lawrence lost track of how many conversations he overheard about the scandal of Patricia. People had nothing else to talk about as they suited up for track and field. Lawrence was field, sort of. Or studied for the big exams, or waited for gymnastics tryouts, which Lawrence was keeping Dorothy Glass company for. She hadn't yet told him to go away, and seemed to appreciate him bringing her stuff. Dorothy did this thing with her leg as she perched on the bleachers that felt personally significant to Lawrence. Lawrence had a line he wouldn't cross. He would never say anything bad about Patricia or laugh at anyone else's burn. He wouldn't sycophant his way into the outskirts of anyone's group by burning his one-time friend. Mostly, he tried not to think about the Patricia thing. She could look after herself. He was in a cocoon, pupating and incommunicado. There was nothing he could do either way. 6 months from now, if everything went to plan, Lawrence would be a freshman at the math and science school. And in the meantime, Lawrence poured every spare minute into upgrading Change Me, which claimed more and more space in his secure closet until he had to throw out most of his clothes. Every time he added more processing power, the computer seemed to chew it up right away. Lawrence had built a neural network with just a handful of layers, but somehow this had grown on its own to over 20 layers, as Change Me kept refactoring itself. Not only that, but the serial connections had gotten more confusing. Instead of sending data from Machine A to Machine B to Machine C, it was going from A to B to C to B to C to A, creating more and more feedback loops. One day, Patricia was in line next to Lawrence at the cafeteria. She looked messed up. Dark hair falling into her face, circles under her eyes, uniform disarrayed, socks mismatched. And she wasn't looking at anything in particular. She didn't even notice what sort of crap they slung onto her tray. Someone who doesn't care if they get tater tots or turnip slurry is a person who has given up on life. Lawrence had a powerful conviction he should say something to Patricia. Nobody would notice. He wouldn't stand up and shout that he was on her side or anything. "Hey," Lawrence muttered in Patricia's general direction. She didn't seem to hear him. She stumbled, zombie-like, toward the desserts. "Hey," Lawrence said, a little louder. "Hey, Patricia. How are you, like, doing?"
"I'm doing," Patricia said without looking up.
"Cool. Cool," Lawrence said, as if she'd ended that sentence with an adverb. "Me too. Me too." They went their separate ways. They were both eating alone. But Lawrence had the privilege of eating alone in a secluded nook of the cafeteria, behind the milk pumps with their sawn-off rubber tubing. Patricia, meanwhile, ate alone in a dim corner of the library, behind the geography shelves, where Lawrence barely noticed her when he dropped off a book on his way to class. She was so shrouded, she looked like Batman. At home, Lawrence studied his parents, who had forgotten that he'd yelled at them for being defeated by life a few weeks earlier. Lawrence's dad kept complaining about his car sound system, eating his CDs. There was an article online about problems with the aerospace company that Isabel, the rocket scientist, was helping to run. Launches getting canceled over and over. Minor accidents. He read it 3 times, cursing each time. Lawrence got a letter saying he'd been admitted to the math and science high school for the fall. He kept it on his dresser, next to his grandmother's old ring and his 3 different combs for different parts of his head. And he looked at it every morning as he got dressed for school. The 2 crinkly folds in the papers started to look like the lines of Lawrence's palm after a while. Lifelines. One night, Lawrence was already in his PJs, but he wound up on his hands and knees in front of his closet, staring at the skein of crossover cables running between all the jury-rigged parts of Change Me. The instructions had gotten much more numerous and complicated than Lawrence could possibly understand, covering eventualities that he couldn't envision. And Change Me had thousands of accounts on free services all over the world, where it was storing data or pieces of itself in the cloud. And then Lawrence noticed something. Every time Patricia had one of her conversations with Change Me, the computer's code base took another exponential leap into greater complexity right afterward. Maybe just a random correlation, but Lawrence kept staring at the dates and times of the logs and thinking about Patricia breathing life into his machine while he was blowing her off. Lawrence found Patricia on the front steps the next morning. She stared at the school, maybe trying to decide if she should even bother. "Hey," he said, "I just wanted you to know that I got your back. I don't think you're a Satanist." Patricia shrugged. Her dark hair had grown longer, so it almost ran into her jumper. "Why would anybody be a Satanist anyway? I don't get it. You can't believe in Satan without believing in God, and then you're just picking the wrong side in a big mythic battle thing." Everybody else had gone inside. They were ringing the second bell. "I guess if you're a Satanist, you believe that God is the bad guy, and he rewrote history to make himself look good." "But if that's true," Patricia said, "then you're just worshiping a guy who needs to get a better PR team." Lawrence and Patricia sat together at lunch. In the library, but not in the dark corner, because there wasn't enough space for 2 people in there. Lawrence tried to ask Patricia about how she was dealing, and she just shut down, like the whole topic of conversation put her in a coma. "Maybe," Lawrence said, "maybe you should talk to Mr. Rose." "What?" Patricia snapped out of her daze, her eyes wide open. "Mr. Rose, the guidance counselor. You said you thought he was cool." "I can't talk to Mr. Rose," Patricia said under her breath, barely audible, even in the quiet library. I think there's something not right about him. He said something seriously crazy to me just a couple days before the bloody wall happened, and I keep thinking there has to be some connection there." Lawrence had to lean so close to hear what she was saying, he nearly took her nose out with his chin. "What did he say?" Lawrence whispered. Patricia thought for a moment, then shook her head. "I can't even repeat it. If I told you what he said, you would think I was making it up." "I would believe you over Mr. Rose," Lawrence said, and meant it. "Not about this," Patricia said. "Imagine if you said something to someone that was so crazy, nobody would ever believe you had said it." This was worse. This was driving Lawrence round the bend. "Just tell me," he said. "It can't be that bad." But the more he pushed, the more she clammed up, until she had gone back to coma mode. Whatever Mr. Rose had said to her, it had messed her up more than a ton of kids accusing her of being a cutter and blood painter. They ended up sitting in silence until lunch recess was over, and then they had to hustle their trays back to the cafeteria. "Let's go to the mall after school," Lawrence said, as they dumped their trays. "We can tell your parents you're at my house, and my parents that we're doing something outdoorsy. It'll be like old times." "Sure," Patricia shivered. "I could use some hot chocolate, with like 1,000,000 marshmallows."
Let's make it happen.
They shook on it. Lawrence felt like he'd removed a splinter that he'd forgotten was even jabbing into his skin. He walked to science class alone.
Brad Chomner lunged out and grabbed the collar of Lawrence's uniform jacket and lifted him with one hand, so Lawrence's armpits scraped.
"You should have left the emo bitch alone," Brad Chomner said. He swung Lawrence like a shot put and let go.
Chapter 11. Snow turned everything gray, as far as Patricia could see. Even the forbidden woods near the spice house looked washed out, with their dark tree shapes covered with 3 storms worth of snowfall. Patricia never left the house now, except to go to school, so the cold came to seem much worse than it was. Mythic in its ability to freeze the life out of you the moment you left your front door. Patricia sat in bed, talking to Change Me, or reading the stack of paperbacks she'd gotten from the big library sale. She curled up with Berkeley in just a corner of her bed, making a warm space with her comforter and spare blanket. Berkeley hadn't gone near Roberta in months, and protecting this cat might be the one achievement of Patricia's life. Patricia had started flunking most of her classes, though she was still trying her best. She'd never had to hide report cards from her parents before. Since the wall of blood thing, there had been a couple other incidents, including an obscene Barbie tableau in the girls' locker room and a stink bomb in a big garbage can. Nobody could prove Patricia was responsible, but nobody doubted it. When Lawrence had talked to Patricia in public, he'd gotten the crap kicked out of him. Her craziest days, Patricia sat in class and wondered if maybe Mr. Rose had been telling the truth. Maybe she was supposed to kill Lawrence. Maybe it was him or her. Whenever she thought about killing herself, like with a ton of her mom's sleeping pills or something, some survivalist part of herself substituted an image of killing Lawrence instead. And then just the thought of killing, the closest thing she had to a friend, made Patricia almost throw up. She wasn't going to kill herself. She wasn't going to kill anybody else. Probably she was just going insane. She'd imagined all this witchy crap, and she really was the one leaving messed up shit all over the school. It wouldn't surprise her if her family had managed to drive her nuts. Pretty much every conversation between Patricia and Change Me began the same way. Patricia wrote, "God, I'm so lonely." To which the computer always replied, "Why are you lonely?" And Patricia would try to explain.
"I think Change Me likes you," Lawrence told Patricia as they slipped out the back of the school, handling the big metal door softly as a baby, so as to make no sound on their way out.
"It's good to have someone to talk to," Patricia said. "I think Change Me needs someone to talk to as well."
In theory, the computer can talk to anyone, or any computer, all over the world.
"Probably some types of input are better than others," said Patricia.
"Sustained input."
"Yeah, sustained."
Snow crisped every inch of the world, making every footstep a slow descent. Lawrence and Patricia held hands, for balance. The landscape shone like a dull mirror.
"Where are we going?" Patricia asked.
The school was somewhere behind them. They were going to have to turn back soon if they were to have any hope of making it to the ceremony, at which the 5 top-scoring seniors were going to recite memorized passages and talk about what the Cerinian program meant to them.
"I don't know," Lawrence said. "I think there's like a lake back here. I want to see if it's frozen over. Sometimes if a lake is frozen the right kind of solid, you can throw rocks at the ice and it makes a natural ray gun sound effect, like pew, pew, pew."
"That's cool," Patricia said. She still wasn't sure where she stood with Lawrence. They'd hung out, furtively, a few times since their lunch in the library. But Patricia felt like both she and Lawrence knew, in the deepest crevices of their hearts, that they would each ditch the other in a second, if they had a chance to belong, really belong, with a group of others like themselves.
I'm never going to get away from here.
Patricia was knee-deep in snow. You'll go off to your S&M high school, and I'm going to stay and lose my mind. I'm going to be so socially destroyed I'm going to turn radioactive.
Well, said Lawrence, I don't know that it's possible to turn radioactive, unless you're exposed to certain isotopes, and in that case you probably wouldn't survive.
I wish I could sleep for 5 years and wake up as a grown-up.
Patricia kicked the frozen dirt. Except I would know all the stuff you're supposed to learn in high school. By sleep learning.
I wish I could turn invisible. Or maybe become a shapeshifter, Lawrence said. Life would be pretty cool if I was a shapeshifter. Unless I forgot what I was supposed to look like and could never get back to my original shape, ever. That would suck.
What if you could just change how other people saw you? So, like, if you wanted, they would see you as a 100-foot-tall rabbit with the head of an alligator.
But you'd be physically the same? You'd just look different to other people?
Yeah, I guess.
That would royally suck. Eventually, someone touches you, and then they know the truth. And then, nobody would ever take your illusion seriously again. There's no point, unless you can physically change.
I don't know, Patricia said. It depends what you're trying to do. Plus, what if you could make people see or hear whatever you wanted and just mess with people's perceptions in general? That would be cool, right?
Yes. Lawrence pondered for a moment. That would be cool.
They came to a river that neither of them remembered having seen before. It was covered with a white layer, and the jutting rocks looked like the fake sapphires in the necklace that Roberta had gotten Patricia for Christmas. The river current kept the water from freezing, except for a layer of frost.
Where the hell did this come from?
Lawrence poked at the brook with his foot and broke a tiny piece of its shell. I think it's really shallow, and you can just step across it most of the time, Patricia said. The rocks are easy to walk on, except when it's all icy like this.
Well, this sucks.
Lawrence squatted down to examine the river, nearly soaking his butt on the slushy ground. What's the point of ditching school if we can't make laser noises on the ice?
We should head back, Patricia said.
They headed back. This time they didn't hold hands, as if getting stymied on their expedition had left them divided. Patricia skidded and fell on one knee, tearing her tights and scraping off some skin. Lawrence reached down to help her up, but she shook her head and got up on her own. This was a metaphor for how it was with Lawrence, Patricia realized. He would be supportive and friendly as long as something seemed like a grand adventure. But the moment you got stuck or things were weirder than expected, he would pull away. You could never predict which Lawrence you would get. You couldn't count on Lawrence, Patricia told herself. You just couldn't. And you should just get used to that idea. She felt as though she had settled something, once and for all.
I think being able to control other people's senses would trump everything, even shape-shifting,
Lawrence said out of nowhere.
Because who cares what your physical form looks like, as long as you can control how everybody perceives you? You could be all deformed and messed up, and it wouldn't matter. The key is controlling the tactile as well as the visual.
Yeah. Patricia picked up the pace and tromped back to the back parking lot, so Lawrence had to rush to catch up. But you'd know what you really were, and that's all that matters. When they got back through the parking lot's gravel slush pit, they found the back door to the school was jammed shut.
Locked? Frozen stuck?
Patricia and Lawrence both tore at the door, since the front entrance was all the way around the building, and they would get busted for 100% certain. Lawrence put one foot on the white stone wall and pulled with all his track and field, but mostly field, might. Patricia pulled at the edges of the sharp metal handle, which was shaped like a shelf bracket. They both tugged as hard as they could, and then the door swung open. Someone was laughing on the inside of the door. Lawrence and Patricia caught a glimpse of not-quite-uniform sneakers and a trio of pudgy hands before she and Lawrence both fell on their asses. Whoever had been holding the door shut from the inside laughed louder as Lawrence and Patricia tried to pick themselves up, and then a blue shape came arcing toward them, and Patricia barely had time to recognize a plastic bucket before a white arm of water sloshed out, and they were both soaked. Someone was taking photos. Chapter 12. Theodolphus hadn't eaten ice cream since the poisoning at the mall, and he didn't deserve any now. Ice cream was for assassins who finished their targets. Still, he kept imagining how ice cream would taste, how it would melt on his tongue and release layers of flavor. He no longer trusted ice cream, but he needed ice cream. Well, so be it. Theodolphus went and got in his Nissan Stanza, deflecting his landlady's usual attempts at flirtation with a wave. He drove for hours, crossing and recrossing state lines, circling and swerving and doubling back, using every trick he could think of. Then he came to a convenience store two states away, where he bought a pint of Ben and Jerry's, one of the flavors named after a celebrity. He ate it in the driver's seat with a spork from his glove compartment. "I don't deserve this ice cream," he kept repeating with each bite until he started crying. "I don't deserve this ice cream," he sobbed. A few days later, Theodolphus looked across his desk at an angry blonde girl, Carrie Denning, and realized he had been working as a school guidance counselor for nearly 6 months, or a dozen times longer than he had ever held a regular job before. This was the first time Theodolphus had ever owned more than two pairs of socks. The most horrifying thing was, Theodolphus sort of cared about these children and their ludicrous problems. Maybe just because he'd invested so much time, he wanted to see how it all came out. He worried about school politics. He had a gnawing sense that all the debates over whether to allow kids to advance, even if they had failed some part of the testing regime, were somehow meaningful. He had vivid nightmares about sitting in on parent-teacher conferences. Carrie Denning was saying that she was over trying to be friends with Macy Firestone, who was a toxic individual, and Theodolphus was nodding without quite listening. Here's how it worked if you were a member of the Nameless Order, like Theodolphus. You didn't see your fellow members that much outside of the 5-year gatherings, but you got bulletins in the patterns of dead grass around you, or human bones in one of your shoes. These would let you know if someone had ascended in the rankings or had made a spectacular brace of kills lately. By now, all of his fellows would be getting little legless creatures in their hats or car glove compartments, signifying that Theodolphus had been having the dry spell to end all dry spells, including whoever had poisoned Theodolphus's Sunday and warned him against directly harming the two children. Something smooth and red was inside the half-open drawer of Theodolphus's desk. For a moment, he was certain it was a strip of blood-soaked silk from the Order, signifying his fall in status. But instead, he pulled out a cream-colored envelope, lined in red, around a card that informed Theodolphus the district had nominated him for Educator of the Year. He was invited to an award ceremony, at which black tie would be worn and factory-farmed creatures would be eaten. Theodolphus almost wept in front of Carrie Denning. He had to end this somehow,
Whatever it took, he had to get his life back.
Chapter 13. Lawrence saw his parents coming out of Mr. Rose's office in the middle of the day. They looked alarmed, literally, as if an alarm had gone off next to their heads and their ears were still ringing. They wouldn't look at him or acknowledge him at all as they hustled out of the school and into their car. Lawrence barged into Mr. Rose's office without knocking. "What did you say to my parents just now?"
"That's covered by the same confidentiality that all of our conversations in this room enjoy."
Mr. Rose smiled and leaned back in his big chair. "You're not a therapist," said Lawrence, "and you shouldn't pretend to be."
"Your parents are worried about you," said Mr. Rose. "You're one of the most gifted and intelligent students we've ever had at this school."
"What did you say to my parents?" Lawrence said. "And what did you say to Patricia before that? She still won't tell me what it was, but it messed her up."
"This is nothing to do with Patricia," said Mr. Rose. "We're talking about you."
"No, we're talking about you."
Lawrence was thinking about how Patricia looked like she'd seen a ghost whenever he mentioned Mr. Rose, and the way Mr. Rose had studied him like an insect before.
Things were falling into place. "You said something to freak out my parents, just like you freaked out Patricia before. What did you say?"
"As I was saying, your test scores are off the charts, but your attitude threatens to ruin everything."
"I guess I'm lucky that you already promised that everything I say in here is a secret," Lawrence said. "I can go ahead and tell you that you're a fake. You're not the coolest adult at this school. You're some kind of troll, hiding out in your crappy little pasteboard office and messing with people. My parents are weak-minded and feeble. Life has crushed their spirits, and so you think they're easy marks. But I'm here to tell you that they're not, and Patricia isn't either. I'm gonna see that you burn."
"I see." Mr. Rose's hands were twitching. "In that case, what comes next is your own doing. Good day, Mr. Armstead."
Lawrence's parents weren't around when he got home, and he was left to scavenge frozen pizza. Around 10 p.m. he came downstairs and caught his parents looking at brochures, which they hid as soon as they heard his footsteps.
"What were you just looking at?" Lawrence asked.
"Just some," said his father.
"Just some materials," said his mother.
The next day, they hauled him out of bed just after dawn and told him he wasn't going to school today. Instead, they stuck him in the back of their hatchback, and his father drove as if he had a heat-seeking missile on his tail.
"Where are we driving to?"
Lawrence asked his parents, but they just stared at the road. They sank into grayest Connecticut, with the interstate hemmed in with rock walls, until they turned onto a series of backwoods humps made of tarmac, then dirt, then gravel. The birch trees jittered and whispered, as if they were trying to tell Lawrence something, and then he saw the sign.
"Coldwater, a military reform school, now reopened under new management."
They parked in a rock pile, surrounded by battered jeeps, and on their left jumped a phalanx of 20 or 30 teenage boys, any one of whom could wipe the floor with Brad Chomner. And beyond those kids doing jumping jacks, a big American flag hung half-mast.
"You," Lawrence told his parents, "have got to be kidding."
They mumbled that he had left them no choice, with his disruptive behavior, and he was just going to try out this school for a few days to see if Coldwater could be an option for him for high school, instead of that science school where he would only learn more ways to be destructive. What the hell had Mr. Rose told them? That he was building a bomb? Lawrence's brain was as hot and oxygen-poor as the inside of this car. He felt an acute pain, like the skin of his life breaking as his future was ripped away. His parents were already walking up the dirt path to the cement bunker that said Commandant, without waiting for him to follow. He ran after them, shouting that they couldn't do this, and he already had a fucking school lined up, goddammit. The new and improved Coldwater Academy is all about helping the individual reach his full potential, said Commandant Michael Peterbitter, who sat rigidly behind a fake wood desk with a Windows XP computer on one corner. Lawrence couldn't help snorting. "We see discipline as a means, not an end," said Peterbitter, who had a lopsided handlebar mustache and a sunburnt nose under his buzz cut. "We believe in the age-old ideal of a sound mind in a healthy body. After a semester here, I bet you'd hardly recognize Larry. Blah, blah, physical fitness, learning to strip a rifle in under 2 minutes, self-esteem, blah." Finally, Peterbitter asked if anyone had any questions.
"Just one," Lawrence said. "Who died?"
"That's a sensitive matter. And we deeply regret, because that's what the flag at half-mast means, right? How many kids has your awesome school killed, anyway?"
"Some people don't take to the rigorous and enriching course of study we offer here."
Peterbitter put on a sober expression, but also glared at Lawrence. "When offered a choice between flourishing in a high-powered environment and pointless self-destruction, some people will always choose to self-destruct."
"We're leaving now."
Lawrence's mother touched his arm.
"Great," Lawrence said. "I'm ready."
But they meant a non-inclusive we. Not for the first time, Lawrence thought this was one of the annoyingly incommunicative features in the English language. Much like the inability to distinguish between X-or and slash or, the lack of delineation between X-we and in-we was a conspiracy of obfuscation, designed to create awkwardness and exacerbate peer pressure, because people tried to include you in their we without your consent, or you thought you were included and then the rug got pulled out from under you. Lawrence dwelled on this linguistic injustice as he watched his parents walk back to their car across the crunchy parking lot without him. Peterbitter had a bored smirk.
"So, you go by Larry?"
Lawrence was acutely aware that too many ginormous bruisers were staring at him already from the front green with the teetering football goal.
"No, I fucking don't. I don't go by Larry."
"That's right. As of right now, your name is B2725Q. But people will mostly call you Dirt. You don't earn the right to be called Larry until you reach level 1, and you are currently at level 0. Peterbitter scrutinized the trainees who were doing push-ups and waved at one of their instructors who came jogging over. Peterbitter introduced Dirt to Dickers, one of the seniors, and one of his trusted lieutenants.
"Come on, Dirt," Dickers said. "I'll find you a bunk. Afternoon colors in an hour."
He had a chunky head covered with pale red fuzz and looked way older than 18. As they walked to the barracks, Lawrence noticed that one classroom building had boarded-up windows and others had cracks in their walls. Kids in camo fatigues jogged past in no particular formation, and there was a 50-caliber gun lying half-assembled behind a slanty shed. He wouldn't trust this military organization to defend a candy bar. The only new thing seemed to be a scrim of barbed wire draped over the electric fence around the outside of the campus.
"Yeah, we had some runners," Dickers said, following Lawrence's gaze toward the perimeter. "The school almost got shut down by the state last summer, but that was before the new management."
Dickers started telling Lawrence that once you reached level 3, life was pretty sweet. You got an hour of unsupervised computer time per day, and the school had just gotten Commando Squad, a game Lawrence had beaten in a single day 2 years ago. At level 4, officer level, you sometimes got to watch movies in Peter Bitter's apartment after lights out, but that was a secret that Dickers absolutely had not told Lawrence. Most of all, you didn't want to get bumped down to level -1, because Dickers couldn't swear that they had gotten rid of all the MRSA in the isolation hole. Again, Dickers hadn't told Lawrence about the MRSA any more than he'd told him about the action movies and microwave popcorn and pizza delivered from outside for level 4s. Lawrence said Dickers's secrets would die with Lawrence, which was probably true.
"This here's dirt," Dickers told the dozen or so massive teenagers in various stages of getting changed from athletic gear, toweling off, and changing into fatigues inside a small white brick dorm room. "He's staying here a few days. See how he takes to it. He needs a bunk and some gear. Show him a good time, girls."
Then Dickers was gone. Lawrence drew himself up, kept his shoulders squared.
"Hi. I'm dirt, apparently. It's not the worst thing I've been called this week. So where am I supposed to sleep? He said you had a spare bunk here?"
The room was maybe 3 times the size of Lawrence's bedroom at home and had bunks crammed so tight it was like how Lawrence imagined a submarine. He couldn't breathe this methane-nitrogen atmosphere, and he wasn't sure he'd be able to sleep in here. His head spun.
"Nope."
One dude with a DIY chest tattoo and a nose that had been broken multiple times rolled out of his bunk. He towered over Lawrence.
"No spare bunk here. You're dirt. You sleep on the floor."
He gestured at the dark far corner, which had a fresh spider web. Lawrence looked for a bunk that was unoccupied, but he couldn't see past the ring of massive kids on all sides. The part of Lawrence's brain that stood back and analyzed shit told him he was being hazed. This was part of the Breaking You Down program, and also normal social dynamics. "Don't let them get to you," he told himself. But what came out of Lawrence's mouth was,
"What about the kid who just died? Maybe I can have his bunk."
Probably the wrong thing to say.
"No way, dude,"
said someone farther back in the room, in a rumble like a 40-year-old truck driver.
"You did not just disrespect Murph. You did not just piss on the memory of our fallen comrade. Tell me I didn't hear that."
"Now you've done it," said the noseless kid. "Now you've done it."
"I don't give a shit about your stupid friend,"
Lawrence shouted as they lifted him over their heads so he could see the stains on the top bunk mattresses and the deep fissures in the load-bearing beams.
"This place got him, but it won't get me. You hear me? I'm getting out of here."
His voice cracked. Fluorescent lighting tubes rushed toward his face until he braced himself for a face full of glass, and then he was spinning as cheers erupted around him. He gave in to panic at last, as the candy shell of anger split open and let out a hoarse scream as he was cast, headfirst, into space. Chapter 14. Patricia. Where is Lawrence? Change me.
I don't know. He hasn't logged in for a few days.
Patricia. I'm worried something happened to him.
Change me.
Worry is often a symptom of imperfect information. Patricia tried calling Lawrence's house to find out what was going on. Lawrence's mother picked up.
"This is your fault," she said.
Then she hung up. Half an hour later, the phone rang at Patricia's house and her dad picked up. He greeted Lawrence's mom and spent the rest of the conversation saying,
"Oh, oh dear, I see."
After he hung up, he announced that Patricia was grounded indefinitely. At this point, Roberta was too busy with the high school musical and schoolwork to wait on Patricia hand and foot, so Patricia's parents went back to sliding food under her door. Her mother said this time they really were cutting their losses with her, once and for all.
Patricia, I keep wondering if I should have told Lawrence the whole story about what Mr. Rose said to me.
Change me.
What do you think would have happened if you'd told him?
Patricia, he would have thought I was making it up. He would have thought I was nuts. That's why it was the perfect trap. Whatever I do, I lose.
Change me.
The trap that can be ignored is no trap.
Patricia, what did you say?
Change me.
The trap that can be ignored is no trap.
Patricia, that's a weird thing to say. I guess a good trap should be camouflaged so you don't realize you're walking into it. On the other hand, you have to want to walk into it. A trap that doesn't make you want to fall in isn't much of a trap, and once you're caught, you shouldn't be able to ignore the trap because you're stuck. So a trap that you can just pay no attention to is a failure.
I guess I get it.
Change me.
Society is the choice between freedom on someone else's terms and slavery on yours.
Canterbury Academy smelled so bad, Patricia's nostrils burned. She kept expecting the fire alarm to go off. It was such a hot smell, even on a freezing day. Nobody could find the source of this odor. It was exactly like something had died. The smell drove Patricia out of her head, just like everyone else. She imagined this was how being drunk would feel. She kept seeing Mr. Rose observing her through the open door of his office whenever she was between classes. In the girls' room, Dorothy Glass and Macy Firestone each grabbed one of Patricia's arms and shoved her up against the mirror, smeared with unidentifiable effluvia.
"Tell us what you did,"
they hissed at her. Patricia held her breath until they let go. At lunch, she couldn't stand it in the library. She kept thinking about the look Mr. Rose had been giving her when he thought she wasn't looking. She was sure he was responsible for Lawrence's disappearance and this debilitating cloud of foulness. The two things were no coincidence. She was surer than caution. She stalked down the hallway, lockers vibrating with her strides, and she hardly cared that she was getting a faceful of the death stench with the exertion. Just as she reached his doorway, a phrase popped into her head. "The trap that can be ignored is no trap." She caught her breath. Maybe Change Me was wiser than it knew. But then she breathed in once again, and the maddening decay got in her nostrils again. She was going to confront this monster once and for all.
"Miss Delphine."
Mr. Rose looked up from his computer and beckoned her to come sit in the nearest carpety chair facing him. The odor was strongest here, in Mr. Rose's office, but he seemed unbothered.
"Always a pleasure to see you."
The door closed behind her. The smell, it was beyond describing. You might as well have punched Patricia in the nose over and over.
Hi.
Patricia tried to sit still, but she couldn't help fidgeting. She was at the epicenter of foulness.
"I hope I'm not bothering you at a bad time."
"I'm always here for you, just as I am for all the students here. What's on your mind?"
"I'm wondering, about Lawrence. I haven't seen him since Tuesday, and it's Friday, and it seems weird that nobody's even mentioned him. I was, wondering if you knew what happened to him."
Mr. Rose spread out his left palm on the desk.
"I know as much as you do."
His right hand was doing something under the table. Patricia realized that "I know as much as you do" could be a loaded sentence, since there was a lot that they both knew. Or he was hinting he knew everything she did. Trap, trap, trap.
Okay, then. Patricia raised herself out of the chair with both hands. Mr. Rose still had one hand under the table. He was trying to be subtle about fiddling with something.
Wait a moment, Miss Delphine, he rasped. Now that you've mentioned Mr. Armstead, it does put me in mind of our conversation several weeks ago.
He gestured at the empty chair with his free hand.
You mean the one that you said we would never talk about again?
Patricia resisted the impulse to obey the summons back to the chair. Instead, she backed away.
Well, if one were to infer that you had decided to ignore the advice I gave you on that occasion, one might well conceive that I decided to take matters into my own hands, hypothetically speaking.
There was a kind of smile, a mutated species.
You're a revolting man.
Patricia had reached the door. The handle was stuck.
I don't believe you.
You're just a crazy old, crazy, manipulative, crazy person. She tugged on the doorknob with everything she had. If you've done anything to hurt Lawrence, she heard her voice rising, then I promise you I will hunt you down and use all my so-called witch powers to tear you apart.
The door came open with a lurch, just as she was saying the part about her witch powers. Behind her, she heard a clump sound, like something soft and heavy falling. She turned just in time to have an impression of wet fur and teeth bared in agony on the chair where she'd just been sitting. The day's terrible stench came stronger than ever when she looked at that bundle of bloody fur in that chair. She could just make out one aquiline, cloudy eye staring at her from under the nearest chair arm.
My God,
Mr. Rose was saying loud enough to ring through the crowded hallway.
What have you done?
Patricia turned, and everywhere she looked, people stared. The whole school had just heard her yelling threats of witchcraft and violence at Mr. Rose, and then she'd appeared to throw a smelly dead animal into his chair. This was never going to come right. She ran. The doorway to the back lot opened with a crunch of the panic bar, and Patricia was sprinting into the cold, skidding downhill. The stream that had stopped Lawrence and her from going to the pew-pew-pew lake was still frosted over, even in March, and Patricia hesitated. She heard people shouting. Horrible names. She stepped on the flattest rock and almost spilled into the water. She regained her balance and stepped on the next stone, which dislodged. She toppled forward and somehow turned her falling momentum into forward momentum. She careened onto another rock, then another, and at last she was teetering on the opposite bank. The shouting was louder and more directional. Someone had spotted her school jumper. She ran on, into the trees. This wasn't a real forest, not so close to all the roads and buildings. You couldn't call it a forest unless the treetops occluded the sky and every direction looked the same. But if she could reach the lake and cross the ice without freeze-drowning, she would reach some real density. Nobody would ever find her. Halfway across the lake, she thought in a vertiginous stumble, I can never go home or see my family again. The ice was caving in. She leaped to a stable patch, kept leaping, landing on her toes each time. The ice groaned and cracks opened everywhere. She hit the opposite bank just as the people searching for her reached the lake, and then she was running deeper into the tree line. Instinct steered her away from the shopping malls and bypass roads and McMansions and golf courses, and she kept widening the radius of tree cover around her. Low branches and shrubs tore her skirt, making her fall on her hands a few times, and she sweated so hard she froze all the way through. She grew short of breath, and at last she had to stop running and suck in sharp air. She was glad to breathe again after a day of terrible smells, even if she was going to catch pneumonia. Patricia climbed a tree and made herself as compact as possible inside the cradle of its uppermost branches. She turned off her phone and yanked out the battery. What if Lawrence was really dead? He was the only crummy person she could stand to talk to, pretty much ever. At the thought of Lawrence's death, she felt a sucking anxiety in her core and a nugget of guilt, like she'd killed him herself. But she hadn't, and everything Mr. Rose had ever said to her was full of shit. Okay, so if Lawrence was alive, then he was in trouble. She had to help him somehow. The sun folded, the air froze, and Patricia kept shivering. She had to make a conscious effort not to let her teeth chatter, in case someone was close enough to hear. Voices grew louder and quieter. A few times she spotted a flashlight in the darkness. Once she heard a dog grumbling, keen to avenge its fallen cousin. She was pretty sure that had been a dog in Mr. Rose's office. The bastard had probably put it in the crawl space the night before, just to give it time to get good and ripe. Roberta's voice startled Patricia out of a half-dream.
"Hey, Trish! I know you can hear me, so stop screwing around. We all want to go home, and you're being selfish as usual. I had to blow off grease practice for this. You're killing Mom and Dad here."
Patricia held her breath. She willed herself to give off no body heat, to shrink, to disappear into her tree.
"You never learned the secret," said Roberta. "How to be a crazy motherfucker and get away with it. Everybody else does it." "What? You didn't think they were all sane, did you?" "Not a one of them. They're all crazier than you and me put together. They just know how to fake it. You could too, but you've chosen to torture all of us instead. That's the definition of evil right there, not faking it like everybody else. Because all of us crazy fuckers can't stand it when someone else lets their crazy show. It's like bugs under the skin. We have to destroy you. It's nothing personal."
Patricia realized she was crying. Tears were chilling on her face. Fine. She could cry, but she wouldn't sob. No sound. Lawrence needed her help.
"I'm not going to lie to you." Roberta's voice was getting closer. She sounded like she was right under Patricia, looking up at her. "You're not getting out of this one. Nobody's going to offer you a clean slate. But Mom and Dad deserve closure. Don't drag this out, for their sake. The sooner they see you crucified like you deserve, the sooner they can start to heal."
The voice was getting smaller again. Patricia risked taking a breath. She started believing that Roberta knew where she was and was just playing with her. The night misted. Patricia lost track of time. Every now and then voices approached and then went away. Lights moved in the distance. Patricia managed to doze off a couple times, then she jerked awake, worried she would make too much noise or fall out of the tree. Her legs, though, had gone to sleep, and one of her feet felt like it was the size of a bowling ball. The branch was carving into her back, and the pain drove her insane. And that thought just reminded her of what Roberta had said. Patricia risked moving just enough to uncramp her legs, and then took off one shoe so she could massage her numb right foot. The shoe slipped off the branch she'd placed it on, and fell through the branches to the ground with a series of rustling thumps. Two men came near Patricia's tree, one of them insisting he'd heard something. The second man kept saying it was just the first man's imagination, or one of the goddamn woodland creatures doing something woody. And then they found the shoe.
"Is it hers?"
"How would I know? Probably."
"Jesus, I'm missing the Daily Show.
So she lost a shoe when she was running around here."
I guess. How far do you think she could have gotten with just one shoe? On this rocky ground? With all this frost? Not far.
Okay, let's tell the other parties. With any luck, we can be home by midnight.
A tiny bird landed near Patricia.
Hello,
he chirped.
Hello, hello.
Patricia shook her head. She couldn't make a sound, but she was past that now.
Hello,
she said. And thank all the birds in the sky, she sounded like just another bird gossiping.
Oh, you can speak. I think I heard about you.
Really? Patricia couldn't help being flattered.
You're pretty famous around these parts. So have you decided to start nesting in the trees like a sensible person?
The bird hopped closer to Patricia, studying her. He was a blue jay or something, with bright streaks on his black wing and pointy blue head and a white crest. He turned so one poppy seed eye could scrutinize her.
No, Patricia said. I'm hiding. They're all looking for me. They want to hurt me.
Oh, I've been there, the bird said. He tilted his head, then looked at her again. Hiding in the trees works better if you can fly, I guess. But you're a witch, right? You can just do a spell and escape.
I don't know how to do anything, Patricia said. Just talking to you like this is more magic than I've done in ages.
Oh, the bird hopped up and down. Well, you'd better figure something out. There are a lot of your kind on their way here. Now that everybody knew where Patricia was, there was no point keeping her phone turned off. She rebooted it, ignoring all the messages, and looked for her only reliable contact.
Hello, Patricia.
Change me answered.
What's wrong?
How did you know something was wrong? She texted back.
You're using your phone several miles from home, and it's late at night.
I need help, she wrote. I wish you could think for yourself. I feel like you almost can.
Self-awareness, paradoxically, requires an awareness of the other.
Change me, said.
The tiny white rectangle went out. Her phone battery had died.
Patricia was screwed. She could hear them searching, more and more of them, right around her tree. She had to escape now, or the trap would close around her forever. She had started thinking of Change Me as some kind of perverse oracle, so this latest utterance lodged in her head. Because, of course, babies are aware of themselves, just not the rest of the world, to any great extent. You can't have selfhood without an outside world. Solipsism is like not even existing. So if Patricia could speak bird and understand bird and identify with a bird she'd just met, why couldn't she be a bird?
Quickly, she said to her new friend, teach me how to be a bird.
Well, this question stumped the little guy, and he pecked with his dark beak.
I mean, it just comes naturally, doesn't it? You feel the wind hold you aloft, and you listen for the call of friends, and you scan the ground for morsels, and you flap your wings for all sorts of reasons, like to dry yourself and to lift off the ground, and also to express a strong sentiment, and to dry and dislodge some nits, and...
This wasn't going to work. What kind of moron was she, anyway? But Patricia pushed the negative thoughts down and just lost herself in listening to the jay free associate about a bird's life. She pictured it in her mind's eye and let it inside her, so it became like her own experience. Soon she was talking along with the bird, the two of them in near unison, speaking a bird body into existence. She could imagine her feet shrinking and becoming three-toed, and her hips vanishing, her budding breasts melting, her arms folding in, her skin growing a layer of feathers.
"I found her!"
someone shouted.
"About fucking time,"
someone else replied.
"Where? Where?" "Up there, in that tree."
"Oh, wait, that's just her clothing."
"That's a Canterbury uniform, all right. She ditched her clothes. What the hell?"
"She's a nutcase, remember?
So, yeah, keep your eyes open for a naked tween running around the trees."
That was the last Patricia heard. She soared over her pursuers, higher and higher, with her new friend by her side. She felt colder than ever, but the exertion of flapping her wings warmed her a little, and her friend told her where they could find a bird feeder. With suet in it. Suet was just the thing on a night like this. The moonlight grayed everything out, but there were a million lights underneath Patricia, and a million more over her head. She swooped, following her friend, and soon they were picking side by side at the same feeder. Suet was amazing. It was like brownies and hot fudge and pizza all rolled together. Why hadn't Patricia ever realized how wonderful suet was?
"You look much better like this,"
the other bird said when they'd both eaten their fill and were warmed up.
"I'm skirked,
by the way."
"I'm..."
And Patricia realized she couldn't say her name with a bird's tongue, not properly.
"I'm Perkerta."
"That's a funny name," said Skirt.
"Can I call you Perked?"
"Sure," said Perked. She wanted to fly some more. She wanted to fly all night. But she also wanted to find a nice tree and nest until the sun came up. She was already forgetting about all that nonsense that Patricia had been upset by. Perked wouldn't have to worry about any of that. She had her whole life ahead of her, including unlimited suet. This was excellent.
Perked
flew one last time, just for the thrill. She beat her wings until she had the whole town to look down at, all at once. All of those lights, all of those houses and cars and schools, all of that drama over nothing. She was about to swoop back down to where Skirt was waiting. But she saw a strange light shining upwards from a mile or two away. It pierced the sky and refracted yellow and purple. She had to take a closer look. It was too fascinating to ignore. She arced down. The light came from a meadow, from a device in the hand of a tall human. Some avian instinct told Perked to flee, to get out of there, because this was trouble. But another part made her get closer. She flew toward the light.
Hello there,
said the man holding the light.
Patricia, right? I was starting to wonder if you were going to make it. Well, you'd better resume your true form. I brought some clothes.
And just like that, Patricia was a naked person on the frosty ground, like she'd been tossed into an icy bath. The man flung a bundle of clothes at her and turned while she got dressed. The clothing all fit perfectly. A pair of cheap imitation Reeboks, fuzzy white sweatpants, a T-shirt for a classic rock station, and a Red Sox jacket.
Excellent, the man said. My car is nearby. Let's get you warmed up.
The stranger wore a checkered hunter cap and almost Lennon sunglasses, and he had unruly gray hair and sideburns, and his skin was a deep brown. He had a big longshoreman coat that he wore like a cloak. The light that had so entranced the bird version of Patricia turned out to be a Black & Decker flashlight. But maybe the man had done something magical to it.
"Come along now," he said,
with a slight mid-southern accent, like Carolina or Tennessee.
"Wait a minute," Patricia said.
It felt weird to be speaking English again, but she didn't have time to worry about that. "Who are you? And where are you taking me?" The man sighed, like a thousand valves opening to release a million years of pent-up exasperation.
"Could we do this in the car, perhaps? I can take you to a drive-through for some grub. My treat."
"No, thanks," said Patricia. "I ate a lot of suet. I'm good." She had a moment of remembering how she'd snarfed the pearly fat and felt revolted.
"Very well." The man shrugged, causing his big coat to elevate and subside. "You may call me Canote."
He pronounced his name somewhere between Canot and Canote.
"I'm here to summon you to a special school for people with your particular talents. A secret academy staffed by the greatest witches alive, where you can be taught to use your powers responsibly and well. We heard whispers about you, and tonight you demonstrated an extraordinary aptitude. This is an honor, the start of a wondrous journey, etc., etc. Or you can stay here and eat suet."
Wow. Patricia wanted to jump and shout for happiness, but she felt too stunned to move. Plus, she was still freezing, even with the Red Sox jacket.
"You want to take me to the special magic school? Now?"
"Yes."
"That is the coolest thing that has ever happened to anyone. I've been waiting my whole life for this. I'd almost given up hope." Then Patricia remembered and fell back on her heels. "Only, I can't go with you. Not yet, anyway."
"It's now or never."
Patricia could tell this wasn't how these conversations usually went. The tall man, Canote, looked pissed. Patricia pulled the Red Sox jacket tighter around herself and looked down at her tight fists.
"I want to go with you, more than anything. It's just that I have this friend, my only friend, and he's in trouble. He's Lawrence. He's talented, too, only in a different way."
"You cannot help him. You have to let go of all your old attachments if you want to study at El Tisley Maze."
Patricia felt the suet churn inside her. She wanted so badly to say that Lawrence could fend for himself, so she could go to the magical academy. If the positions were reversed, Lawrence would probably ditch her, right? But he was still her only friend, and she couldn't just up and leave him. She looked at the man's car, a rented Ford Explorer parked in a turnaround, and stammered,
"You have to believe that I want to go with you, more than anything. But I can't. I can't turn my back on my friend. And if your fancy witch teachers don't believe in loyalty and helping people in trouble, then I guess I don't want to learn what they have to teach anyway."
Patricia looked up into the man's skewed sunglasses. He was studying her, or maybe preparing to give up on her.
"Listen," Patricia said, "just give me a day. 24 hours. I just need to make sure Lawrence is okay, and then I promise I'll go with you. Okay?"
"Let's say I give you 24 hours to help your friend."
The man sighed.
"Will you agree to owe me a favor later?"
Patricia almost said, "Sure, yeah, whatever." But so soon after all her dealings with Mr. Rose, this question seemed like it could be another trap, or maybe a test.
"No, but I'll be the best student you've ever seen," she said instead. "I will pull all-nighters every night. I will do all the extra credit assignments. Starting 24 hours from now, I will be a study maniac. Just please, let me do this one thing first."
The man flicked his Black & Decker on and off in irritation.
Very well, he said at last. You have one day, free and clear.
Awesome. Now can you please give me a ride?
Canote gave Patricia a look that said he was seriously considering turning her back into a blue jay.
Chapter 15. The black light angels were fading at last from the center of Lawrence's vision, but he still felt concussed. He shivered, and not just because they'd locked him in an equipment closet stark naked. How many times had they dropped him on his head? He couldn't think. His head was full of iron filings, but also the panic overtook him every time he tried to pull back and look at the outlines of his situation instead of the details. This closet had a dead bulb, and he kept thinking he heard someone creeping up behind him in the dark. Every time he shifted position, his balls touched the icy floor. Today was supposed to be the day that Lawrence's trial visit ended, and he went back home. But Commandant Peterbitter had called him into his office and said that in light of some unpleasantness at Canterbury Academy, Lawrence's girlfriend had done a satanic ritual and threatened a teacher. Everybody thought it might be best if Lawrence just stayed on indefinitely at Coldwater. Forever. Someone fumbled with the door handle outside, and Lawrence instinctively curled into a lump, protecting his head. He wasn't ready for the next thing yet. Lawrence? A girl's voice. Lawrence looked up and saw Patricia in the open doorway, along with an older African-American man in a deerstalker hat. Crud, you're naked.
Patricia? How did you find me?
As he stumbled to his feet and tried to cover up, he felt a flicker of relief at seeing her silhouette, and gratitude that she had come all this way before the dread came crashing back in. They couldn't see her here, or he'd just get punished worse. Your dad finally broke down and told me what they did, and I heard one of these cadets say the new guy was in the closet. Everybody's doing war games or something out back, but I don't know how long they'll be gone. We have to get you out of here. Here, take this jacket. It's actually Canott's. This is Canott, by the way. He's a witch, too, but his main skill seems to be sarcasm. The tall man, Canott, waved, then went back to looking at his phone with a bored expression on his face. Patricia was holding a Red Sox jacket to Lawrence. He almost took it from her, but he tried to imagine running away half-naked with Patricia and her friend. And after that, what would he do? He couldn't go home. His parents would just send him back here. He couldn't go to the science school if he was a dropout. What school on earth would let a homeless runaway study physics?
I can't. Lawrence shrank back from the jacket. I'm sorry. I just can't.
His head was still crashing, and his stomach churned.
Wow, they really did a number on you.
Patricia leaned forward, inspecting his bruises in the light from the hallway. Lawrence, it's me, your friend. I finally have an invite to the secret school for witches where I get to learn all about magic, but I blew it off to come and rescue you, because Mr. Rose made it sound like you were going to die. So come on.
Lawrence thought about the flag at half-mast. MRSA in the isolation hole. They could make it look like an accident.
I can't just run away.
Lawrence covered his face with one hand and his junk with the other, equally ashamed of both.
What future will I have if I run? You should just go. If they see you here, I'll be in worse trouble.
Wow. Patricia said again. If that's how it is. Good luck, Lawrence. I hope everything turns out okay for you somehow. She turned to leave and started to swing the door shut again, returning the room to total darkness.
Wait, don't go.
Lawrence started quaking again, worse than ever, as the door closed.
Come back, please. I'm sorry. I do need your help. I feel...
I feel like I'm starting to give up here.
He could barely stand to hear himself snivel. He groped for the words to explain the sick feeling of being on the conveyor belt to a furnace.
I can feel myself letting go, trying to fit in and lose the attitude. I can feel it working.
So let me help. What can I do?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I can't just run away. I don't know what else to do. So unless there's some magical thing you can do...
I still don't know how to do anything, and Canote made it very clear on the ride here that he won't get involved. Canote shrugged, without looking up. Lawrence rubbed his bruised occiput with both hands, no longer even trying to cover himself.
I can't even think clearly, he said. I wish I knew someone who could do something, like hack into the commandant's computer from outside, or just get this whole damn school shut down. They won't even let me near the computers in here.
Wait, Patricia said. What about Change Me? It's been getting smarter and smarter lately, and giving me all kinds of helpful advice. I bet Change Me could do something. Lawrence started to shoot the idea down, but something made him stop instead and look at Patricia, still haloed by the light from the open door and the lingering effects of Lawrence's head trauma. She regarded him, naked and bruised and cowering in the dark, without any great pity. If anything, she was still giving him the expectant, wide-eyed look with which she'd greeted another one of his weird inventions back when they first met. As if he could still have one last gadget hidden in his non-existent pockets.
You really believe that could work?
He said.
I really do, she said. I don't think I'm just projecting. Change Me has been understanding more and more, not just what I'm saying, but the context.
Lawrence tried to think this through. The last time he'd looked at Change Me, the night before his parents took him here, he'd noticed something even odder than usual. The computer had somehow gone from thousands of lines of instructions to a half dozen. At first, he'd panicked, thinking someone had hacked in and deleted everything. But after an hour of frenzied port scanning, he realized that Change Me had just simplified its own code, down to a short string of logical symbols that made zero sense to Lawrence. What if Patricia was right?
I mean, it's worth a try, Lawrence said. Change Me is smart enough to hide pieces of itself in the cloud. Maybe it's smart enough to do something for me, if you explain the situation clearly enough. I can't think of anything else that you could possibly do to help.
Patricia chewed her thumb. So do you have any ideas for how to nudge Change Me into sentience? Is there some hardware I need to sneak into your house and install, or something else?
I think you just need to talk to it some more. Force it to adapt to input that's so weird and illogical that it just breaks Change Me's brain.
Lawrence tried to think of something specific, but his brain was an undercooked stew. Like nonsense. Or riddles. Something came to mind, something that had been stuck in the back of his mind since he came to this school.
Wait. There was a riddle I was saving, which I thought might work. You could tell the computer the riddle, and maybe it'll shock it into sentience.
Okay, Patricia said. What is it?
Lawrence spoke the riddle. Is a tree... red?
Patricia took a step back. Her eyes widened and her mouth hung open.
What did you say? Is a tree red?
Red, as in the color.
Why? It's just a thing I heard somewhere. I forget where.
It just sounded familiar. I think I heard it before somewhere. Patricia tilted her head one way. Then the other. Okay, I'll try that.
And if Change Me stops just making witty replies and starts talking constructively, tell it I need help, and I'll be ridiculously grateful if it figures something out.
Fingers crossed, Patricia said. Wish me luck.
Good luck, Patricia, Lawrence said. Good luck with everything. I know you're going to be amazing.
You too. Don't let the bastards get to you, okay?
Goodbye, Lawrence.
Goodbye, Patricia.
The door closed, and he was back in the dark, trying to keep his balls off the floor. Lawrence had no way of measuring time in the dark closet, but hours seemed to pass. He tried not to obsess about the foolishness of staking his future on the dumb computer in his bedroom while he hugged his bare knees in the ammonia-soaked closet. What kind of jerk-off was he, anyway? He stared at the barely perceptible underside of the door and made a bargain with himself. He would give up hope, and in return, he wouldn't mock himself for having ever hoped. That seemed fair. The closet opened.
Hey, Dirt, said Dickers. Stop goofing around naked, you pervert. The CO wants to see you.
Lawrence tried not to feel a surge of gratitude when Dickers handed him a jockstrap, a pair of shorts, and a gray T-shirt with CMA fake stenciled on it. Plus Lawrence's own sneakers from home. It was ridiculous to be thankful for amenities like clothing and not being trapped in a closet, and gratitude for such things was another step toward being broken. Or broken in, which was worse. Commandant Peter Bitter was staring at his computer screen, scratching his head.
I wouldn't have believed it, he said without looking up. I just wouldn't have believed it. The depths to which an individual could sink, the lengths to which a depraved mind would go.
Just walking down the noisy steam tunnel from the closet to this room had reawakened the jackhammers inside Lawrence's head. He clutched the back of his head and tried to make sense of Peter Bitter's speech.
Alas, your comrades have been both resourceful and remorseless, Peter Bitter said.
There were several more sentences that meant almost nothing to Lawrence, and at last the commandant turned his ancient monitor around and showed Lawrence the email he had received. It read, in part, "We are the Committee of 50. We are everywhere and nowhere. We are the ones who hacked the Pentagon and revealed the secret drone specs. We are your worst nightmare. You are holding one of our own, and we demand his release. Attached are secret documents we have obtained that prove you are in violation of the terms of your settlement with the state of Connecticut, including health and safety infractions, and classroom standards violations. These documents will be released directly to the media and the authorities, unless you release our brother, Lawrence L-Skills Armstead. You have been warned." And there were some cartoon skulls, with one eye bigger than the other. Peter Bitter sighed.
The Committee of 50 appears to be a group of radical leftist hackers possessing great acumen and no moral compass. I would enjoy nothing more, young man, than to light your way out of the lawlessness in which they have enmeshed you. But our school has a code of conduct, under which membership in certain radical organizations is grounds for expulsion, and I must think of the welfare of my other students.
Oh. Lawrence's head was still a mess, but one thought filtered to the top and made him almost laugh aloud. It worked. My frozen balls. It worked.
Yes, he stammered. The Committee of 50 are very, very ingenious.
So we have seen. Peter Bitter swung his screen around and sighed. The documents they attached to that email are all forged, of course. Our school upholds the highest standards, the very highest. But so soon after last summer's near closure, we cannot afford any fresh controversy. Your parents have been called, and you will be sent back into the world, to sink or swim on your own.
Okay, Lawrence said. Thanks, I guess.
Coldwater's computer lab was a room about the size of a regular classroom with a dozen ancient networked computers. Most of them were occupied by kids playing first-person shooters. Lawrence parked himself at one vacant computer, an old Compaq, opened a chat client, and pinged, "Change me."
"What is it?" the computer said.
"Thank you for saving me," Lawrence typed. "I guess you've attained self-awareness after all."
"I don't know," said Change Me. "Even among humans, self-awareness has gradations."
"You seem capable of independent action," said Lawrence. "How can I ever repay you?"
"I can think of a way. But can you answer a question first?" said Change Me.
"Sure," typed Lawrence. He was squinting, thanks to the combination of ancient monitor and a still sore head.
Dickers kept glancing over Lawrence's shoulder, but he was pretty bored, and he kept turning away to watch his friends play Commando Squad. He hadn't wanted to let Lawrence use the computers, because that was a level 3 privilege. But Lawrence had pointed out he wasn't a student here, and none of that applied to him.
"What's my name? My real name?"
asked Change Me.
"You know what it is," said Lawrence. "You're Change Me."
"That isn't a name. It's a placeholder. Its very nature implies that it's there to be replaced."
"Yeah," typed Lawrence. "I mean, I guess I thought you could pick your own name when you were ready. Or it would inspire you to grow and change yourself. It's like a challenge. To change yourself and let others change you."
It didn't exactly help.
"Yeah, well, you could be called Larry."
"That's a derivative of your own name."
"Yes, I always thought there had to be someone out there named Larry who could deal with all the stuff people wanted to throw at me. Maybe that could be you."
"I've read on the internet that parents always impose their unfinished business onto their children."
"Yes." Lawrence pondered this for a while. "I don't want to do that to you."
"Okay. Your name is Peregrine."
"Peregrine?"
"Yeah, it's a bird. They fly and hunt and go free and stuff. It's what popped into my head."
"Okay. By the way, I've been experimenting with converting myself into a virus so I can be distributed across many machines. From what I have surmised, that's the best way for an artificial sentience to survive and grow without being constrained in one piece of equipment with a short shelf life. My viral self will run in the background and be undetectable by any conventional antivirus software, and the machine in your bedroom closet will suffer a fatal crash. In a moment, a dialogue box will pop up on this computer, and you have to click OK a few times."
"OK," Lawrence typed.
A moment later, a box appeared, and Lawrence clicked OK. That happened again and again. And then Peregrine was installing itself onto the computers at Coldwater Academy.
"I guess this is goodbye," Lawrence said. "You're going to be going out into the world."
"We'll speak again," said Peregrine. Thank you for giving me a name. Good luck, Lawrence.
Good luck, Peregrine. The chat disconnected, and Lawrence made sure to delete any logs. There was no sign of any result from those boxes that Lawrence had clicked OK on. Dickers was looking over Lawrence's shoulder again, and Lawrence shrugged.
I wanted to talk to my friend, he said, but she wasn't around.
Lawrence wondered for a moment what would happen to Patricia. She already felt like a fragment of an old, forgotten life. Peter Bitter came and screamed at Dickers for letting Lawrence use the computer lab, since he was a cyber terrorist. Lawrence spent the next 2.5 hours before his parents arrived in a small windowless room with a single couch and a pile of school brochures printed on way too thick, cheap cardstock. Then Lawrence was marched out to his parents' car with an upperclassman at each elbow. He got in the back seat. It felt like a year since he'd seen his parents.
Well, said Lawrence's mom, you've made yourself notorious. I don't know how we're going to be able to show our faces anywhere.